Welcome to Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio, where we explore the people, places, stories, and events in our Central Iowa community. Thank you for tuning in. I am Mike Metz, your host for this hour, along with engineer Mike Murphy and our neighbor and Milford Township resident naturalist, Pat Schlierbaum. Anna Magnuson, alias Anna Banana, joins our bunch later in the hour to share her heart-to-heart and tune-in Tuesday messages. Pat, you know, some rain would sure be wonderful these days.
I don't know about your place in the hinterland, but it's dry.
Sure.
And it sure welcomes some filling up these important ephemeral ponds that
Definitely.
Frogs and toads need.
I saw a frog hopping out of our pond last night, and he had to dust himself off.
So. Oh, yeah, it's that dry.
I saw her sitting in the rain, raindrops falling on her. She didn't seem to care, she sat there and smiled at me. Then I knew she could make me happy. Flowers in her hair, she crept into my mind. I knew I had to say hello. She smiled up at me. Then she took my hand and we walked through the park. She simply caught my eye.
I love the flower.
She seemed so sweet and kind. She crept into my mind. Suddenly the sun broke through. I turned around, she was gone. One little flower in my hand, but I knew she had made me happy.
She had
flowers in her hair, flowers everywhere.
I love the flower.
Was she reality or just a dream to me? Her love showed me the way to find a sunny day.
And that weather and flower moment was brought to us by the cow sills, the rain, the park, and other things. And we are happy to welcome Dr. Molly Lee, Associate Director of the Center for Food Security and Public Health at Iowa State University's College of Veterinary Medicine. Hello, Molly. It's been about a month since our last visit.
Yeah, good morning, Mike. Happy to be here this nice April day.
Yeah. Say, what are the updates with respect to the COVID-19 pandemic? Do you have something to share with us?
I do. So I just kind of, you know, run through the cases, what we know here in Story County particularly. And I do like to mention kind of a quick nationwide update. And I say this because I know, you know, some folks travel or want to travel or have friends and family outside Iowa. So in the country, we're still reporting about 64,000 cases a day on average, which is really similar to the peak of the surge last summer and really only slightly lower than this time last month. So just a reminder, again, it's kind of a matter of perspective, a lot fewer cases than in the last few months, particularly the end of 2020. But there are still a lot of people who do get this virus every day. So that's the kind of bad news. The good news is that death rate has fallen quite a bit. So we're down to a little over 800 deaths per day nationwide compared to about 2,000 per day last month. So, you know, of course, while we certainly rejoice every decrease in death rate, this pandemic is still very much present, and those 800 people or somebody's family member or friend, and that's still significant. In Iowa in the past month, we've lost about an additional 88 people to the virus. In our county, we've lost 47 people. So back to the good news again, our positivity rate continues to trend downwards. Currently in Story County, both the 7 and 14-day positivity rate are around 5%. Unfortunately, that's actually a little increased, about a percent up from this time last month. ISU's weekly positivity rate is also just over 5%, which is up about 2% last month. And then Story County schools continue to have occasional cases, which vary by district and building, but in general, absenteeism due to illness, which is kind of the metric we're looking at right now, has generally remained less than 3%, which is about the same as last month.
I know that you've mentioned nationally and, of course, statewide, the fact that as people start to travel, we still need to we still need to practice good hygiene, especially wearing masks in public. Even, in my opinion, even if you have been, you've received your second vaccination. I know those of us here in the studio, we all have received our second and feel somewhat relieved, but we're still wearing our masks and such in public or in groups that were considered not our pod.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly. And that's the CDC guidance as well, is that we're not quite ready with the number of cases you just heard about as a nation to, you know, totally open things back up and not wear those masks in public. If you are vaccinated and have both your doses, if you got a two-dose vaccine and have waited that period of time after your second vaccination to gain your full immunity, the CDC does advise that you can gather in small groups, either with other vaccinated people, and that's indoors, usually at, you know, a private residence or some non-public place, safely without a mask, or in a group with other low-risk unvaccinated people. So a classic example would be for vaccinated grandparents to visit with their unvaccinated but low-risk grandchildren.
Yeah, and from what I recall from my immunology class back many years ago, 2 to 3 weeks is a period after that second that you would be considered at your highest immunity rate, and so that's when you could probably loosen, at least with your pods, your intimate groups, but still practice those other safe practices in the public.
Yep, that's just right. Two weeks after your second shot or your first shot, if you got the Johnson & Johnson, you know, is kind of the number we're going by. And everybody's immune system varies a little bit, but that's a good rule of thumb. And this is great news. You know, it's tough that the public side of things, you still have to be careful. You know, we're not out of this yet, but it's really great to be able to gather with, you know, friends and family who are vaccinated or low risk if you're vaccinated.
Yep, definitely agreed. Say, I've got a question. You know, you talked about the percentages going up a little bit. Could that perhaps be somewhat accounted for by the recent holidays and breaks for folks?
Yeah, like many of the, you know, surges, big or small, that we've had throughout this pandemic, we're not always able to pinpoint it to a specific thing, but generally as travel increases, as more flights are booked, as more people move around the country, that tends to very consistently correspond with increase in cases. So spring break and Easter holiday, it's probably a little early to tell if that made any effect, but if folks traveled for spring break, then that might be showing up now. That's definitely a potential reason for the increase in cases.
Yeah, okay. The governor recently announced that those 16 years and older are now eligible for their receiving their first inoculation. How is that going to work out? What is your opinion, or how you see that working out? Do we have the logistics in place to accommodate that increased number?
Yeah, that's a good question. So I'll talk about kind of in a general sense first, and then what we're doing in our county. I think logistics are going very, very well for COVID-19 vaccine distribution. It was definitely a big challenge and a big hurdle at the beginning. It still remains a monumental effort by those in our healthcare and public health fields. But there have been many counties that have held clinics, many medical providers that are moving through this very efficiently and effectively. And the vast, vast majority of people that I speak to who have gotten a vaccine have been very pleased with how the logistics have gone. So as far as whether or not, you know, you're 16 or 20 or 30 or 40 and able to get a vaccine easily, kind of depends on where you're at and your timing, and a lot of different factors. So the potential sometimes imbalance between vaccine supply and demand, rather than kind of the logistics of coordinating it, remains that biggest barrier, but it's improving all the time. A lot of our more rural counties tend to be able to vaccinate those younger people. Here in Story County, our allocations are remaining similar to previous weeks, and demand still exceeds supply. So we are working through folks still. We're getting younger and younger, and as individuals contact our Story County Health Department, for example, if they don't have a medical provider of their own, we will give them the vaccine if they are 16 and up. But we otherwise are still kind of working through clinics for those higher risk groups. And the governor has given permission for counties for which vaccine demands still do exceed supply to continue with that prioritization. So of the vaccine that we've received in our county, some of that will be kept by the public health department for that tier two group, which right now is food, agriculture, distribution, and manufacturing workers who live or work in a congregate setting. So that's kind of a more high-risk group. And then the remainder are distributed to the medical providers to use how they choose to use in their facility.
And we'd like to let our listeners know, this is from personal experience, I know of at least one octogenarian who wasn't able to get their first inoculation, and I helped get them signed up. So there are still folks in those higher age groups and folks who have medical situations that do need, if they so desire, do need to get their inoculation scheduled. And so if I'm doing kind of a call out to folks that if they know somebody in that situation and they need some help, try to help them along. And because the more we folks we can get into the system and protected, the quicker this is going to help us, and the healthier our population will be.
Yeah, that's exactly right, Mike. And that's great. We want everybody to get a vaccine. You know, that's the goal. That's what will get us out of this pandemic. But definitely, if you know someone older, those are the population that has been and remains the most susceptible to this disease. So definitely, there's a lot of mechanisms to try to find those vaccines, and there's a vaccinespotter.org that can look for vaccines in our state. You click on Iowa and it searches all the different pharmacies, and then your medical clinics, your medical providers, primary care providers. There's lots of different options. So any way you can facilitate that for someone else is definitely a win for everybody.
That sounds great. So is there anything else you'd like to add before we close for the day?
You know, just kind of repeating those high points for what we just said, that I can't emphasize enough that all of the currently available vaccines for COVID-19 are effective. They're safe. They're always increasing their availability every day. So the more folks are vaccinated, the more that life will return to the normal we knew before COVID. And feel free to take advantage of some of those loosening restrictions by gathering with other vaccinated people or low risk others if you're vaccinated. And hopefully we'll get to that point soon in the public.
Yes, and continue to wear your mask in public and practice good hygiene. We're so close to, you know, if you use a football metaphor or whatever, so close to that goal line, we don't want to drop the ball now.
Exactly, really important.
Thank you, Molly.
Thanks, Mike.
As I went down in the river to pray, studying about that good old way, and who shall wear the starry crown, good Lord, show me the way. Oh, sisters, let's go down, let's go down, come on down. Oh, sisters, let's go down, down in the river to pray. As I went down in the river to pray, studying about that good old way, and who shall wear the robe and crown, good Lord, show me the way. Oh, brothers, let's go down, come on down. Come on, brothers, let's go down, down in the river to pray. As I went down in the river to pray, studying about that good old way, and who shall wear the starry crown, good Lord, show me the way. Oh, fathers, let's go down, come on down. Oh, fathers, let's go down, down in the river to pray. As I went down in the river to pray, studying about that good old way, and who shall wear the robe and crown, good Lord, show me the way. Oh, mothers, let's go down, come on down, don't you want to go down? Come on, mothers, let's go down, down in the river to pray. As I went down in the river to pray, studying about that good old way, and who shall wear the starry crown, good Lord, show me the way. Oh, sinners, let's go down, come on down. Oh, sinners, let's go down, down in the river to pray. As I went down in the river to pray, studying about that good old way, and who shall wear the robe and crown, good Lord, show me the way.
And that was Alison Krauss and the Union Station, Down to the River to Pray. And we're waiting for Billy Beck, assistant professor and extension forestry specialist, to join in, and we're having some difficulties. So what we were going to talk about with Billy is there is a project out there, excuse me, to reintroduce beaver into the, especially the Des Moines Lobe or central portion of the Iowa area, to help with nutrient mitigation in some of the river systems. And I know, Pat, when you were working with the DNR, you had some experience with beaver. Yeah. And I know some other folks that have had what we would call distress calls of distress because the beaver were in many people's minds, looked at as vermin. I mean, these are large rodents. They're the second largest rodent in North America.
Yeah, they are. They eat plant material, so they're a delight to anybody who enjoys beaver. The thing that comes to mind for me is back in the 1930s, I once read a newspaper account from the Leon Journal, where I grew up in Decatur County, that they had planted two beaver in the DeKalb area, 1936. And I guess everyone recalls there was drought in that era. And they were planted as a means of conservation, and they were looking towards water retention, even in the 1930s. And, you know, beaver kind of founded this country in many regards as far as the Northwest expansion. Started off with beaver trapping. So they were a resource that was highly desirable and then just about got wiped out. And so the appreciation can take on different levels. But there are people that, a great destination is a beaver pond, because it backs up and you creates a pool, and it does a lot of good things that rushing water needs to be mitigated, and the beaver are right there pulling for the system. But yeah, if they need a better PR relationist, you know, with people, it seems.
Causing or creating a pool does change the habitat. It slows that water down, so the nutrients have a chance to settle out and be taken up by the vegetation that grows in those areas. I know it would seem like central Iowa is an ideal system for that, because we don't have a lot of what would be considered cold water areas, and that's always been a concern for those fishers who are interested in the salmonoid species like our trout. We have up in northeast Iowa, and of course and the northern states. I know folks are always trying to rid their area of beaver to protect their prize brook trout and that sort of thing.
Pretty isolated areas can be impacted. I guess a term might be negatively, by slowing the water down, and that trout stream would be changed. Boy, overall, in the big picture, you would hope that they would be able to accept a few beaver. The thing that also comes to mind is when we brought the river otters to Iowa. Now, they were wiped out. And in their return, we learned the first year, 1985, that they occupied active or inactive beaver lodges. So the beaver and the otter kind of go hand in hand, and now we have otters, fortunately, in all 99 counties. The beaver have had something to do with that success.
You know, that's interesting you bring that coexistence up between those two species, because research has shown that beaver, there are other animals that will share that lodge, especially in the wintertime. And Pat, Billy Beck has joined us now, and Billy, sorry that we had some difficulties there, but I don't know if you were able to hear some of what Pat and I were talking about over the radio.
I was not. Nope. Sorry.
Yeah, what we were talking about was the fact that central Iowa seems like an ideal spot for beaver dams, because we don't have the cold water concerns for trout fishers and things like that. We've got about 10 minutes, so I'm sorry we'll have to cut you a little short, but could you give us a general overview of what the project is about and what you're finding out?
Yeah, sure. Again, thanks for having me. Good morning, everybody. So we actually just started this project. It's kind of been a dream of ours, kind of a side project dream for a long time. We do a lot with water quality and managing stream side areas to promote water quality. And we've always noticed that these dams definitely have an impact. We just didn't know what the impact was. So this study is really looking to get, you know, are these things impacting water quality? And what may that be? So we have about three objectives here. The first one is to look at the water quality impacts of the dams. So reducing nitrogen, phosphorus, sediment, and things like that. And the second objective is looking at the hydrologic impacts of the dams, or how do the dams impact how water flows through the streams? How does it, they impact downstream flooding or localized flooding? How do they impact groundwater tables? And then lastly, we're going to look to blow the effects up to the scale of the entire watershed. So we're going to be looking at the differences caused by these individual dams, but then we're going to kind of look and say, okay, if we allowed them to kind of establish at spots where they would normally do that without persecuting them or, you know, just maybe promoting habitat so they would expand, what would the water quality impacts of that be? So again, we're really looking at the water quality, the water quantity, or which I'll call like flooding and groundwater table rise and all that stuff. And then finally, we're really curious to see what the impact would be if they did, were allowed to spread out a little bit more. And again, we're not really looking to promote these. We're really just looking to get answers like what are the impacts of these structures and these animals? Because if they do have a positive impact, these could represent a free conservation practice, a free water quality practice that could be useful in meeting the objectives in the Iowa nutrient reduction strategy. So,
right.
So we just kicked it off. We got a really great grad student starting. We're focusing on central Iowa streams. We've identified six dam complexes, and we're getting ready to rock this spring. So very exciting.
So are they? Is there any one of these study areas near central Iowa as far as Iowa State University, or are most of them scattered up the Des Moines lobe?
Most of them we're trying to keep within an hour of Ames just for, you know, feasibility and time in the field. So we've got kind of what I'll call two different dam types. The first type are the first ones we ever kind of encountered or actually kind of, you know, walked around and actually started taking notes and really watching closely. And those are the streams that drain directly into the Des Moines River. So if you've ever been along that corridor, it's very hilly. There's a little bit more forest cover over there. And the slope of the streams is a little more steep.
Sure.
We'd see kind of away from that corridor. And the second group of dams we're looking at, we'll call more of a typical agricultural watershed on the Des Moines lobe. So a lot of the streams have been straightened or channelized, and it's a heavy, heavy row crop component to the watershed land cover. So, and most likely a higher nitrate concentration and phosphorus concentration. So we're really excited to see the differences that the dams have in those different landscapes.
So the animals that you're talking about would probably be those that would be a second-year animal that move out into the stream, say, away from the Des Moines River, to perhaps try to colonize somewhat? Because I know the beaver along the bigger river systems, we term more or less bank beavers because they don't necessarily need to build a dam or in that fact even really construct a lodge because they can burrow into the bank and use that, correct?
Correct. Yeah, it's been fascinating to learn about their ecology of these critters. But yeah, you're right. You know, we've noticed that there's a certain stream size. When you get bigger than that, they simply don't build the dams unless it's a very dry year. So for example, around Ames here, we kind of had a low flow winter, and the beavers built a dam that spanned the Skunk River, which was very impressive. But again, the first high flow we get in the spring, that thing's going to be gone. So,
sure.
Even in the smaller streams, you'll notice that when it's drier, when we have low flow years, they'll establish a series of dams there. But once we get some high flow years, they will revert to living, kind of burrowing in the bank and kind of making these pseudo lodges of, you know, they've got their bank den, but they've got some sticks, kind of a half lodge created in front of that entrance. So,
sure.
Yeah, it's really, I'm kind of hoping for a low flow year so we get some dams established. But even when they blow out and they get destroyed, they definitely have a water quality and quantity and even an impact on the shape of the stream. because during high flow events, the river will cut around the dams and create new river meanders. So even when they're not there, the legacy and the material that's put into the channel still has an impact. So that's kind of interesting that they don't need to be actively maintained to really have a water quality and quantity impact.
So. Yeah. Now, a couple of quick questions for you here. There are a lot of folks that, in my case, I have a prairie marsh that is about half of what it should be this time of year for water amount. And I would just love to have a beaver out there because I've got about 2,000 cottonwood and trying to keep the willow and such out of my prairie area. But, you know, I'd only want them there for, you know, I'm one of these, only want them there when they're doing good, of course.
Yes.
And they would definitely, my neighbors, I'm sure, who farm adjacent to me, probably wouldn't appreciate them if the water built up too much. But could you describe, you know, a prairie marsh more or less has muskrats, and you see all these little huts, and I've had folks that aren't familiar with both of those mammals. They think those are little beaver huts. And I say, well, no, the bigger ones are the muskrat homes and the smaller ones are their safe feeding station areas, and beaver are different. Could you just briefly describe the differences in those two animals?
I'm not sure I could. I am not a wildlife biologist. I know that their size difference, their feeding habits are different. And you're right, their kind of living structures are different. But gosh, I couldn't take that one.
Okay.
I'm more of a forester hydrologist.
We'll just have to have Adam Janke or Jim Pease on sometime.
Yes.
Yeah. Or Pat can dust off his memory on those things. Pat?
Yeah, the only thing I could say is I don't think the muskrats will actually dam the flowing stream water.
No, they won't. No.
Nope.
No. Well, okay. So if for just hypothetically, if this proves that there is a mitigation to the nutrient reduction and your nutrients, your heavy metals, for example, settle out so the plants can take those kinds of things up and improve the water quality, what can you speculate on the future for the beaver in central Iowa?
Well, perhaps, again, we're just kind of seeing if there are impacts at this point. You know, it's one piece of the puzzle. It's not a silver bullet like every kind of conservation practice. We're not going to solve the water quality quantity issue with putting beaver dams every 500 meters in a stream. But it's definitely an important piece. So perhaps they're persecuted less. Perhaps we manage our riparian areas to promote them. And again, I'm living on planet Earth. I know the issues that they cause in agriculture and when you've got infrastructure in the floodplain there. So it's not like I'm living in some alternate, you know, reality. I know the issues that they cause. But perhaps we could just start recognizing their value and maybe trying to promote them where appropriate, where they're not going to negatively impact agriculture, because they do offer maybe a free conservation practice, whereas a lot of times very valuable practices like cover crops and riparian buffers do cost money to establish and maintain. These are kind of a free thing that nature's given us that can have some big impact potentially. So hopefully a recognition of their value and a promotion of them, I would say.
Hey, Bethany, this is Keith.
Okay.
If you could give me a call, just want to have some conversation with you about there.
Okay, Dr. Billy Beck, we'd sure love to have you come back maybe at the end of your study session to find out exactly what you found out. I know we'd be interested, and I'm sure a number of our listeners would be.
I'd love to. And in fact, my grad student couldn't make it this morning, but she would be a really good person to kind of – she's really been out there looking at these and observing them a lot this spring, getting ready for our full-blown data collection over the next 2 years. So even this summer would be fun to come back and kind of share what we've learned on the water quality side of things. And I'm learning biology and ecology too about these as we observe them more and more. So yeah, I'd love to. In fact, if folks have sites around Ames that they know are, you know, kind of beavers frequent, or they have dams on their property, I encourage them to give me a shout. Just search me, Billy Beck, Iowa State. Shoot me an email, and we'd love to come out and check them out.
And so, we will add that into our program, so that's available. That'll be available on our website. Thank you, Dr. Beck.
Thank you, Mike. Have a good one.
Susan Guiasta, welcome. It's good to start a Tuesday morning out with you, and I see we have Keith Abraham with us. What do you have before we visit with Keith?
The thing is, Keith has so many things. We were just talking about him last week, how many projects we have going on right now in Parks and Rec, that I don't want to steal any of his time. Let's go right ahead and get into some of the projects that Keith is working on.
All right. Thank you. Hello, Keith.
So yeah, just a number of things that we've got going on, and I'm not sure we'll hit them all. But we do have some celebrations that are going to be coming up. One on May 1st, we're going to be doing ribbon cutting for the Lowhead Dam, which we've talked about before. May 19th, which is something that we have not talked about, at 5 p.m., we're going to be doing the Emma McCarthy Lee Pedestrian Bridge that we're in the progress of constructing right now. And what that does is that makes a connection over the creek in McCarthy Lee. From the park to the open access. And it is a very well-used path and bridge that we have, kind of connects that area to the university. So that project should be finishing up the first part of May, and we're looking at doing that celebration on May 19th. We are planning on doing a grand opening for Miracle Park, and thank the numerous donors that helped make that possible. And again, thank Thames Foundation for their work in that project. It's getting a lot of use. It's great to see. We don't have a date yet set for that, but most likely maybe late May or sometime in June we'll be doing something. And then Homewood Clubhouse, we'll be doing a ribbon cutting, hopefully maybe the end of this month or the first part of May, but that project is again getting close to the end. We should be doing a walkthrough with the contractor next week and kind of putting together our punch list and those items that need to be completed, and then we should hopefully if all goes well, we should be able to open the clubhouse the week of April 19th. So we'll keep our fingers crossed on that one. So those are some of the celebrations. Mike, any questions on any of those four?
I'm sure that it gives you a good feeling that to see folks already using the Miracle Park, for example, and some of these other areas, it's gotta be, you know, I know there was some controversy about that in the neighborhood, but gosh, the folks that are using it and enjoying that facility, it's got to give you guys a good feeling that it's ready for ceremony.
Oh yes, very, very much so. And you know, it's interesting. One of the comments that I've heard several times is that when we talked about the inclusive playground and the Miracle League field, that people felt that the project was just for people with disabilities, and it couldn't be any further from the truth. And what's great to see is people of all abilities, kids, adults, and so on, you know, out there using that that facility together. So long overdue for the community. That's another comment that I get. Where was this? 20 years ago. And so on, but yes, Mike, it has been a wonderful addition to the park system and to the community, and everybody that goes out there is just having a great time.
That's great. That's got to give you guys a good feeling to see that. So,
very much so.
What else have you got for us? I know there's at least something called a pad that was trying to make a splash.
Very good. We do call it a splash pad. But right now, Parks and Recreation Commission last week, Thursday, recommend the City Council approve placing that or constructing the splash pad at Daly Park. And we'll be taking that to the City Council next week on April 13th to have that conversation with them. And Right now we're working on, we have an RFP out for a request for proposal for consultants to do the design. But yeah, that's going to be a fun thing, about just under 5,000 square feet. We'll have in-ground spray features. It'll be above-ground spray features, water cannons, potentially a dump bucket. You know, just a lot of different water types of activities in that splash pad. And what's neat about it is there's no standing water, so anybody can use it. We'll have it on a timer, so people can go and activate the features at any time between a set time of hours, such as 11 a.m. to 7 p.m., whatever that may wind up being.
Well, that sounds great. I'm sure there are folks out there just waiting. They're going, what are we waiting for here? Let's get this going. Huh? I know it's early in the morning for these terrible bits of humor, but
no. We got people that are really excited, you know, about it. And with any of the projects, there are some concerns, but we try to work with the neighbors and with individuals and try to address any concerns that they may have. But yeah, that's an exciting project. Unfortunately, with construction and so on, that probably will not open up until, you know, the first part of 2022. So that's when that will happen. But some of the other projects that we have going on, so Access A to Hayden, which is an accessible canoe and kayak launch, met with the organizing group last week out at A to Hayden. And I don't know why we didn't wait for a day like yesterday or today with it, but we were out there and spent about an hour, and I was freezing by the time we got done with the wind blowing and so on. But with that project, it's in the CIP, Capital Improvement Plan. Money is available as of July 1st. But the Access A to Hayden group has been tasked with raising $35,000 with this project, and they're down to about $6,000 that they need to raise.
Yeah, and so, I just want to add, I know for a fact that there's a cedar strip canoe that they're using as a fundraising device, and I would encourage nobody, because I want to win that canoe. but I would encourage our listeners to get a hold of somebody from that organization, either A to Hayden or the, I believe it's the Outdoor Alliance, and or the Skunk River Paddlers, and contribute, because that is such a worthy project.
Yep, and you can make donations, I believe, on our website. We do have a flyer that has some ways that you can donate. And again, if I was actually really looking that I was going to win that canoe, Mike. I already bought my tickets.
Well, I'll tell you what, we'll both win it, and we can cut it in half.
Yeah, well, you know, I was out at Jack's buying my tickets, and there were people out there talking about if they win it. One individual wants to turn it into a coffee table, and another individual wanted to do what you said, cut it in half and make bookshelves out of it.
Oh,
and it's if you haven't seen it, if you're not a canoeist, I would just recommend going out to Jack's. They have it on display, and it's just a really good piece of craftsmanship.
I have to say, I could just, the irony would be somebody would do that to a canoe and then read about canoeing.
yeah, loaded with canoeing books, right?
Yeah. Keith, you've got one other thing we need to visit before we wrap it up, and that is the downtown project, the downtown plaza. Do you have something you can help our listeners understand?
Yeah, just with the, you know, that's going to be in the parking lot directly east of City Hall, and just over just about an acre of land. We did work with Confluence to get an initial design so we could submit it as part of the Iowa's Reinvestment District Program. We haven't heard yet any information from that program as far as if we're going to get selected. And the Indoor Aquatic Center is really one of the main projects that we're looking to try to fund. But with the Downtown Plaza, you know, we'll be continuing to finalize the design and hopefully this next fall, early winter, we can put that out for bid and start construction sometime in 2022. But it will be a year-round plaza, urban park, whatever you want term you want to use. But it will have a water feature, you know, in the summertime. We'll have restrooms there in the wintertime. We're looking at some type of ice skating facility there. So just a lot of different components. There'll be areas for food trucks, maybe a small musical stage, some areas, trees and green space just to go down and just relax in that downtown setting. So that's where we're at with that project.
Any other projects, Keith, before we wrap it up this morning?
Yeah, I would just let people know that we have a couple of shelters going into to the park system. One is at Franklin Park, which is on Franklin Avenue, just south of Lincoln Way.
Right.
We're hoping to by the end of June to have that shelter, you know, up in the park system. We're doing a little bit of rearranging with playground amenities, but we'll be doing that. Hira Park, which is the old Edwards School site, and on Woodland, and with that one, we'll be putting up a shelter, a basketball pad, and some walking paths, you know, through the park. So that will be happening, this year. At Ada Hayden, you know, just a shout out to people is that we will be doing some repairs to the fishing pier. If you've been out there at all, there are some repairs needed. And it'll be a pretty major overhaul. We'll be taking all the decking off, the railings. We have to level the pilings back out, reconstruct it, and we're going to do some a little different thing with the railings. With it, but that may happen sometime this summer, you know, depending on what type of bids we get. So that's something that will be taking place. And if you have been by, you know, we talked about the Miracle Park. If you've been by there, you've seen some shared use paths, a lot of dirt being moved. And with that, we'll actually have a path along 24th Street, east of Duff Avenue, and then also along Duff Avenue from 24th Street all the way up to the northernmost entrance of the park. And what that will do is that will connect with the Miracle Park and so on. And actually people will have about a half mile loop that they'll be able to walk. But it's also anybody getting off of the Sci-Ride. There's two stops right there. They'll be able to get right onto the path and have easier access to the Miracle Field and the playground. So those are a few things, and I have more on my list, but I know you probably have other people to talk to, and Anna's been pretty quiet, so I'm sure she's got some things that she'll need to share as well.
Well, thank you, Keith. I just hope, it sounds like to me, with all the projects that you and the crew, the staff have got, you're going to be so tuckered out, you're not going to be able to enjoy those. We're going to be walking in one of those facilities and see you hanging there in a hammock someplace.
Yep. I do put that up between a couple of trees now and then. So if you see that, Mike, I just ask that you don't come and wake me.
Thank you, Keith. Thank you, Susan, for joining us, and we'll see you again.
All right. Thank you. Have a great day.
You too.
Daylight come and me want go home. Work all night and a drink of rum.
Daylight come and me want go home.
Stack banana till the morning come.
Well, Anna Banana, you've got 7 minutes, and we've got to have you slip in here and do your thing.
All right. It's Tune In Tuesday as I try and tempt you to listen to KHOI. So today starts with a flashback to the Tuesday when Don Wishart was a guest on the Heart to Heart Messages show to talk about Kiwanis and Food at First. We shared what Jim Dane, who served as a Nebraska-Iowa district governor for Kiwanis, had to say, which was this. When I think of the heartland of the United States, I immediately think of Nebraska, Iowa, and the rest of the nation's Corn Belt. It is inconceivable that anyone would be hungry in our nation's breadbasket. Yet statistics show that our major cities and rural communities have food insecure households where kids don't know when or where they will see their next meal. These kids are our future, and our goal is that every kid wakes up in an environment where they feel happy, healthy, safe, and loved. And that starts with good nutrition. And then we had Diana Sickles, who served as the co-chair of the Childhood Hunger Service Project, was brought into our conversation with this heart-to-heart message. In order to accomplish our goal to alleviate childhood hunger across Nebraska and Iowa, we need to begin by asking four questions. One, what's already happening in our community? Two, how can our Kiwanis Club help? Three, what isn't happening in our community that needs to be? And four, what can our Kiwanis Club do about it? So these questions actually will be answered on the Donna Lana Kitchen show today. The dynamic duo will take a look at the Food at First organization and aims and some of the fine volunteers that make it happen, which include Don Wishart and Bernie White, who will share their efforts to get food from local donors to folks that need a good meal. And Don and Bernie are Kiwanians. So what is this Donna Lana Kitchen show? Donna Lana Kitchen talks about food, farming, recipes, advice, and opinions. Chef Donna and Farmer Lana explore the local food scene with lively discussion and good humor at noon today and repeated at 7 on Tuesday. So now here's another poem by it's a quote that I think that you'll like, Mike Metz. So research shows that many children who do not have enough to eat wind up with diminished capacity to understand and learn. Children don't have to be starving for this to happen. Even mild undernutrition, the kind most common among poor people in America, can do it. And that is a quote by Carl Sagan.
And so Anna, I've just got to say that you thought I would like it, and I don't like it, but I appreciate that information so we can do something about it.
Yes, well, I meant to say that not that you would like the quote itself, but that you would like the person who said the quote, who is Carl Sagan.
He's out of this world.
Exactly. And speaking out of this world, what is happening on Science Bites today?
Well, co-host Sam Wormley and I have been receiving a number of questions from various sources, listeners and folks here, the staff. And so if you tune into to Science Bites at 4:30 p.m. today, you may get an answer to some of life's basic questions.
Ooh, that sounds good one. Well, if you tune in after that at 8:30 p.m., you get to spend time with me for the Heart to Heart Messages show. I select songs to match to the guest messages and our Heart to Heart conversation. So this show tonight explores how I have adopted the belief that home is where the heart is with my guests who live in Ohio and Iowa. Representing the Buckeye State is Kelly Brown, a native of Dayton, Ohio. And representing the Hawkeye State is John D. Thompson, who lives in Pella. So they'll find out, tune in to find out how they would convince my celebrity crush to move to Ohio or Iowa. And so for all those who love Iowa, I dedicate these lyrics to you, and we'll see if Mike Metz can guess the lyrics or the songwriter from these lyrics. Your rivers held me in their arms, a child who dreamed her dreams, and carried me where snakes and fishes go, Iowa, beautiful land. So, Mike Metz, can you guess the songwriter and singer for that song?
Well, it was the singer was Jeff Brown, the writer was Bonnie Kulak, and it was Love is a Many Splendid Things.
Right and wrong. So find out if you're right by tuning in tonight at KHOI 89.1 FM. And a sneak preview to what is ahead this Thursday, if we have time. Mike Murphy, what's going on with You Name It on Thursday?
Well, as you know, April is National Poetry Month, so we're going to be exploring the intersection of poetry and music on You Name It Thursday from 2 to 4 p.m. And I really have been scratching my head trying to figure out why they put National Poetry Month in the month that's hardest to rhyme with.
Good point. That's right. So that's a challenge to you listeners out there. Give Mike Murphy a call with your poem with April in it. See if you can't rhyme April with something. And I'm going to move forward to today again to Tom Russell, because he'll be playing Someday My Prince Will Come, Snow White to Colorado of Salzburg, Good Prince, Bad Prince. It's all covered on today's All Things Piano show. All Things Piano airs at 2 p.m. every Sunday and then repeated, luckily for us, on Tuesday mornings at 9 a.m. So I know we're on a time crunch, but there are a lot of reasons to tune into KHOI. It's time for Anna Banana to split. So until next time, I will love you bunches and send you out with a happy Tuesday.
Thank you, Anna. Mike. Thank you, Anna.
You have been listening to Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio. Remember that you can also hear it online at khoifm.org and find links to the guests and information you heard during the program.
This program is produced by Lynn Carey and Ursula Rudenberg and engineered by Mike Murphy. Thank you, Mike. And you heard from Dr. Molly Lee, Dr. Billy Beck, Susan Guiazda, and Keith Abram. I have been your host, Mike Metz.
Please consider becoming a member of this fine community radio station with your financial support. Go to our website at khoifm.org and press the yellow donate button to begin the process of becoming a member.
And Anna?
Our theme song, as always, is Backtracking by Tom Richards and Al Harris from their CD, The Ballad of Kate Shelley. Stay tuned for Democracy Now! At 8 a.m. and Morning Masterpieces at 9 a.m. Remember, you, the listener, are what makes KHOI meaningful and possible. Thank you for listening. Thank you for supporting KHOI. And
see you again on the radio.
John Halo from Ames.